Before we start, I want you to use your intuition as we take a closer look. Remember, you have enough experience to make the decisions. You are adequate judges. You don't have to have a science degree. You don't have to have gone to college to make sense of the things that you see. Does it pass the smell test? Does it make intuitive sense for the things that we're going to look at to be the results of random processes that are unguided? Or does it make more sense that the things that you see are the result of a plan and a purpose and an intelligent creator behind it? Do these features leave us without excuse? If you're going to have to bear with me again, we're going to be dealing with science. We're like, this has been so bad so far. Okay, if you don't like science, it's going to get maybe a little bit rough as we get into the next several slides. The purpose, though, is I want to look into you. I want us to look into your bodies and how your bodies are made. The various terms aren't important. When we talk about these scientific and chemical terms, don't get hung up on that. Get caught up in the beauty and the magnitude of your body, what you think you know so well, that there's marvelous things that are going on inside of you. And remember, science is fun. I think it's fun. That's why I pursued it. David saw God in the human body. When he looked at the human body, he saw the power of God. Psalm 139, 13 through 14. For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. But we know more than David knows today. We know how much we are fearfully and wonderfully made. So we're going to talk about the average human body here. If you don't know, this is Bill Bennett at Murray Road. Thing one and thing two. So we have about 78 different organs within our body that are comprised of about 11 different major organ systems. We have the skeletal system, our bones, is typically made of about 206 bones. Some of you may actually have more than 206 bones. Some people are born with a few extra bones here and there. Your muscular system has about 640 named muscles, and it's estimated that all in all, within your body, you have 37 trillion different cells. So that's 37 followed by, let me get this right, 12 zeros. 37 followed by 12 zeros. Our current life expectancy is 79 years. Within that current life expectancy, if you live 79 years, your heart will have beat an average of 3.3 billion times, and you will have taken over 660 million breaths. And it's important that every one of those heartbeats occurs, and every one of those breaths occurs. We don't think about that muscle beating all of the time. If you just take the time to try and do this with your hand, clench your hand about in rhythm with your heart, you'll realize how quickly your muscles tire. But your heart is a different kind of muscle. It's designed and made completely different than every other muscle in your body so that it doesn't wear out. It can contract over and over again every few seconds for 79 years. And then when you work hard and you exercise and you run, it can beat even faster. A magnificent creation. So, now let's look a little closer. Let's now move into the circulatory system. What makes up our hearts? Our heart is part of this larger circulatory system that's made up of veins and arteries. Here on this diagram, the arteries are colored in red. The veins are in blue. Arteries is what takes blood away from your heart. Your heart pumps it through. Initially, blood comes to your heart. Your heart pumps it to the lungs. It comes back from the lungs oxygenated. And then the heart pumps it out of the heart again through the rest of your body to oxygenate your body. As it goes through your body, it's going to deplete itself of oxygen. It's also going to pick up waste products. It's going to come back to the heart, and it's going to recycle all over again. In the adult human body, there are about 100,000 miles of blood vessels. To give you a sense of that, That means if you were to take all of your blood vessels, your veins, your arteries, your capillaries, and you were to stretch them out end to end, it would wrap around the earth four times. That's how long the blood vessels are within your body. And it's an incredible transport system. But now, if we look even a little closer, and we start looking at the individual blood vessels, remember, there are actually three different types of blood vessels. We have your arteries, your capillaries, and your veins. And they're all made completely different, because they have different purposes. If you feel your pulse, when you feel your blood pressure, that's from your arteries, because their heart is pushing that blood through your body. Because of that increased pressure, your arteries have to be strong. Your arteries actually have a thick-walled muscle around them in order for them to withstand the pressure of the heart pushing that blood through it. Remember, that heart has to push that blood through half of that, so over 50,000 miles worth of blood vessels, the heart has to push that blood through. So there's a lot of pressure there. They get smaller and smaller and smaller as that blood distributes out throughout the body. Once they get to the capillaries are one cell thick. So the arteries have got thinner and thinner. And once they get to the capillaries, they're one cell thick, and they are so small that the blood cells have to line up one by one as they go through. The reason why they're one cell thick is because that is the sufficient thickness for the oxygen to leave the red blood cells and go into the surrounding body, and then also for the carbon dioxide to pass through those cell walls and to get caught up in the red blood cells themselves. Now, once they go through the capillaries, they're no longer under pressure, but they still have to go back up to the heart. The veins are constructed completely different. Because the blood isn't under pressure, they don't have to have as thick of a muscle wall because they're not dealing with as much pressure. But the blood will backflow because it's not under pressure. The blood in our legs, if it's just gravity, it'll stay in our feet and our legs will swell. So what it's done is we have these check valves inside of our veins. These check valves so that the blood will only flow one way. So the blood pushes through that check valve, and then the check valve closes so that the blood can't come through. And what is pushing the blood up to the heart is all of the blood backing up as it comes through the capillaries. Incidentally, when we get varicose veins and spider veins, it's because those check valves have failed. And our veins swell up a little bit because those check valves aren't catching that blood. But all that blood is going through one gate, through another gate, and through another gate, eventually making to the heart. And once it gets to the heart, then it's repressurized again and pushed through the rest of the body. But even then, when we start looking a little closer at the blood composition, blood is made up of all of these things. Our blood is it's roughly 45 to 55% solids, and the rest of it, it's made up of liquids. Those solids are the red blood cells. We have about 45 to 50% of our body is going to be made up of these red blood cells. Those red blood cells are what carry the oxygen from our lungs to the rest of our body, then capture the carbon dioxide, bring it to our lungs so that it can pass out. But within our blood, we also have all kinds of other things. We have clotting factors. We have our immune system has white blood cells within there. We carry platelets in there. This complex mixture that is our blood. It's more than just this thick viscous fluid. There is a very, very complex biochemistry to that. But even then, if we were to look even closer and start looking at cells themselves, we could see that not all cells are the same. Within your bodies, you have about 200 different types of cells. Those cells perform different functions. Your skin cells on the outside perform a specific function, which is different than your stomach cells and your heart cells, your brain cells, your bone cells, your muscle cells, and so on. And as we've mentioned, we actually have three different types of muscle cells. We have cardiac muscle cells, we have skeletal muscle cells, and then we have smooth muscle cells. All of them perform different functions. And the body knows, each cell knows its job. Incidentally, each cell has the, except for red blood cells, each cell has the exact same copy of DNA, but it only uses a small portion of that DNA that's specific to the function of that particular cell. Now, if we look even closer, now let's start looking at within the cells themselves. Each cell is its own little city, has all of these small things within it. In Darwin's time, when they could look at, with the microscope, the cells looked like these little blobs. They knew that there was this massive stuff in there, but they didn't think it had any structure. They didn't really think there was much more complex than the cell. But now, with modern technology, we realize that the cell has all kinds of microstructures within it. The center of the cell, the brain of the cell per se, is the nucleus. Inside of the nucleus, we have all of our genetic material. But outside of this, we have the powerhouse, which is the mitochondria. We have the ribosomes, which are what's translated, which are the protein-making factories. We have the Golgi apparatus. We have the endoplasmic reticulum. We have all kinds of things that are within the inside of the cell. On the outside of the cell, the outside of this cell, even though it's not shown here, it's coated with all kinds of transmitters. There's chemical signals that are out on the outsides of those cells, sugars and proteins, so that cells can recognize one another, so they can talk with one another. They're always communicating by sugars and electrical means and chemical means. There's all kinds of stuff that goes on inside each one of these cells. In addition, eventually the cells will decide to reproduce. And they'll split, and a heart cell will create another heart cell, or a stomach cell will create another stomach cell. Now, let's look at just one aspect of the cell. Let's look at the nucleus. The nucleus is this ball that's inside of our cells, and inside of the nucleus is where we have our genetic information, that information that defines who you are and what you look like and why Jeremy went bald at 18 years old and so on. That's where the nucleus is at. That ball, that bag of the nucleus has these little pores that allow materials to go in and out. That chromatin, that genetic material, if we were to stretch it out, it just keeps going and going and going and going. Imagine taking spaghetti and wrapping it up around little rocks, and then taking those little things and wrapping themselves up around stuff. That's what the genetic material looks like within our cells. So they unwrap. They're in these chromosomes. We have within our bodies, we have 23 chromosomes. And we have two copies of each of those. One came from your mom, one came from your dad, and they work together. And ultimately, as we were to unwrap it completely, we would finally get down to DNA. And DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, that's the language of life, is what that is. That's what defines everything about you, is within the code of DNA. And the structure of DNA is incredibly simple, but it allows for a massive amount of complex information. It looks like a ladder that's been twisted along itself. This twisted ladder, and the rungs of the ladder are called nucleotides. There are four different the sides of the ladder are made up of different bases. There are phosphorus and sugar bases. They're all lined up, and incidentally, they line up in one direction, and the opposite side, they line up moving the completely different direction. Inside these rungs are these four different nucleotide bases. Those nucleotide bases, those four letters of your genetic alphabet, is all that it needs to define who you are and to come up with the language of life. It is a non-repeating, completely random arrangement of those four letters. But that's all that it takes. Super simple, but yet such a powerful means of passing on the message of life. But, so we see that DNA is a source of information, but it's only a source of information for the cell. It's not actually the action part of the cell. DNA doesn't do the work of the body. All of the work within a cell is done by something that's completely different. It's done by the enzymes. So think of it this way. Think if you have a factory that's being run by robots. The robots do the work, but the robots are being told what to do by the computer programs. So your DNA is your programming that is telling your enzymes what to do. Your enzymes or your proteins do all of the work that's necessary for life. Your enzymes build tissue, they break down tissue. They create energy, they use energy, they eliminate waste, they digest food, they heal your wounds, they transmit messages within your body. When you think a thought, there's enzymes involved. When you walk, there's enzymes involved. When you talk, there's enzymes involved. They are the workforce of the body. This picture here is that rotary motor that we talked about in the bacteria, spinning that little tail. That is made up of those enzymes. They are built based on the code of DNA. So what makes up these little workers? So we have this enzyme, this little ball of particles. Inside of there, even though it's this mass of particles, there's really only one spot that's called the active site that does all of the work. If we are to stretch that enzyme out, we can see that it's made up of all of these individual little chemicals that are called amino acids. Each one of these are individual building blocks within the structure. They are specific to that structure. If you are to change the arrangement, you're going to change the structure of the enzyme and you're going to change how it works. So, how do you get from DNA, the language of DNA, to the language of the enzyme? And this is the fourth example of things that show that we are designed, and that's language. I want us to think a little bit, well, real briefly, about what is language. It's how we communicate with one another. It's how we pass on our thoughts. We can use words in a structured and conventional way. And it can either be spoken or written, but it's used within this community of individuals. So let's explain a little bit about what language is. Say I'm talking with Michelle, and I have an idea in my head. Michelle, I want a car. And I have this idea in my head that I want a red Corvette. And I'm trying to pass that idea from my head into her head so that she can visualize that same idea. Well, that's what language is trying to transmit my thoughts accurately into your head so that you come up with the same thought and envision the same thing. So I pass that on, and Michelle in her thoughts, she's, okay, Jeremy wants a red Corvette. Breakdown in languages is when I'm trying to pass on my thought and it doesn't get passed on very well, and instead she starts thinking of a red Volkswagen Bug. So here we have a breakdown in communication. So it's not just passing on information. That transmittal of information has to be accurate so that the thought in one entity is accurately transmitted to become a thought in the other entity. So, what are the characteristics of languages? Well, the individual component of our language is words. And words have meaning. They're specific and consistent. We teach our children words. They may hear a word and they ask, what does that word mean? Within the language, within a defined language, the word always means the same thing. So, and it's understood by the sender, and it's also understood by the receiver. There's every once in a while you hear about these things, and I wish I could remember the word, but there's a word in English that word in German means poison. And so it's the same letters, same arrangements, but because it's a different language, the meaning is different. Your sequence of elements within those words, the letters, must remain unchanged for the meaning to remain the same. So let's think of three letters, A-E-T. We can arrange those letters in multiple different ways and get functional words, but because the arrangement is different, the words mean different. T, T-E-A, ate, A-T-E, eat, E-A-T. It's all the same three letters, but they're different words with different meanings because of their arrangement. When I was in college, I was taking a chemistry class, and the first day of this was a particularly difficult chemistry class. A lot of us had a lot of angst going into it. And the professor passed out the syllabus, and my buddies and I were looking at the syllabus, and we started laughing. And the professor, and he knew us and knew that we could kind of be troublemakers. He goes, "All right, what's so funny?" And I said, "Dr. Thompson, can we hold you to your syllabus? Is your syllabus, is this exactly how you want the course to go?" And he goes, "Well, yes." He goes, "Why? Why that's so funny?" And I said, "Well, could you look at this line? He meant to say cheating is not allowed, but he flipped the T with a W, and it actually said cheating is now allowed." And he said, "No, we're not following my syllabus this semester." So that's why the arrangement of letters is important. Language also, different languages have different elements, but you can't switch them. Here we have the word walking. We recognize that because we recognize the letters within that. This here is the same arrangement of actual letters, but because it's not the English language, we don't recognize that word because it's not a functional word. You can't mix and match different letters from different languages and come up with functional words. We have other rules of grammar that affect meaning. If we forget a comma, "let's eat, comma, grandma" changes if you pull out the comma and now say, "let's eat grandma." I thought it was funny when I wrote it at 10 o'clock at night. All right, so we're going to go ahead and stop here. It's 5 till. What we're going to talk about later on is whether or not we can get language from random processes, or if language is something that has to have intelligence behind it. So, all right. So now we're going to pick up with this question of, can you come from language? This idea of effectively passing on thoughts. Can you come up with language just through randomness? So I tested this theory a little bit. The average human, the average word in the English language is 5 letters long. So I got onto a website that could come up with random arrangements of 5 letters. And I have 100 random arrangements of 5 letters. How many actual words do you think I came up with? There's 0. So out of 100 times when I randomly threw 5 letters together, there were 0 functional words. Like, okay, well, maybe that was too hard of a challenge. Let's go ahead and try 3. So here within 3 letters, again, we have 100 combinations of 3 letters. And in here, they're buried within here are 3 words, row, peg, and cop. So even with a really small combination of just 3 letters, out of 100 chances, only 3 times did we get an actual word that came up with the human language. So what this shows us is that it's very difficult and very rare for random arrangements of letters to actually come up with a word in the human language. Well, let's say we start, and here's an example. We play Boggle at my house every once in a while. And Well, every once in a while, because, and you'll find out why. I thought playing Boggle with my dad was bad because dad just throws anything up against the wall in hopes that he'll come up with a word. And most of the time he doesn't. So my girls, actually all three of them, have come up with the same stunt. That they'll look through here, they'll find a lot of the legit words, but then it's become a game to try and come up with combinations that are actually words in this Boggle dictionary. We have a Boggle dictionary that are real words, especially ones that you wouldn't think are words. Well, I wrote down all of the combinations that they thought were words but are not. And here are the things that they came up with. Now, in the English language, every word has to have a vowel in it. And there are certain rules of construction, so on. Some of these things we think, that's not a word. No, none of these are real words. But they thought that they were. And it just shows that it's even when we follow some basic rules of word construction, that it's still... And why aren't any of these real words? Because we have not assigned a meaning to them. Every year, we add new words to the dictionary because someone comes up with a word, comes up with a definition, and then passes that on to other people. And they then incorporate that into their own vocabulary. Well, that process has not occurred with any of these things here, like jobber. Now, maybe some of you may think, well, jobber is a funny sounding word. I'm going to come up with a definition, and maybe in 20 years we'll actually have a word in the English language that's jobber. But even here we have, it's very difficult to randomly come up with real words. So let's say we start with real words. Let's see if we can randomly take real words and come up with a functional sentence. So the average sentence is 12 words long. So I said, I want you to give me, it's 12 or 15, come up with a random arrangement of 12 to 15 different words. And I tried it, let's see, 5 different times. I never came up with a real sentence, but every once in a while, we stumbled across phrases that could be real phrases. For, let's say, we have real hate, limp past, cover four, spot crooked, damage greasy, we got actually three here. Boil damage greasy. And I don't want to know what the rest of that sentence is. Boil damage greasy. And then wish elderly and so on. So we can get very small snippets of phrases that could be sentences, but when we randomly try and throw words together, we don't come up with functional meaning. It just doesn't happen. So what does that mean in the broad scheme of things? Well, with language has rules which have to be obeyed in order for that language to impart a meaning. And those rules are that it starts with the combination of letters. Those different elements have to be arranged in a way that makes sense, that imparts a known meaning. And that meaning has to have already been assigned and recognized within the community of people who are going to use that language. The meaning and intent has to come before the word exists. And here we found the longer the length of that combination of letters, the less likely it is to randomly generate a meaningful word. Word order and sentences have rules of logic and syntax, and we didn't even get to that. Rules like questions generally always start with who, how, what, when, and certain words that start out with the sentence. And then we have inflection within the tone of our voices. We can say the word what in several different ways. What? 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 You know, it's the same word, but the inflection passes on different meanings to there. So ultimately, what does all this mean? You don't have language without intelligence. That the intelligence has to come first. in order for there to be a working and functional language that can pass a thought from one entity effectively to another entity. So what does that mean? And here's another aspect of language. Does anyone recognize this? Yeah. Is it a language? Yeah, this is the binary language. It's the language of what? Yeah, it's the language of computers. Does anyone know what this says? You know it's a language. You recognize there's information here, but what do you need to have happen before you can use this information? It has to be translated. In binary code, this is Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. So while we might be able to see information and know that there's information there, unless that language is translated for us, it's not usable. And that's the same thing that occurs within ourselves. That the translation of languages also requires intelligence. Someone to recognize it and to translate it into the language that you and I can understand. So what's the point? DNA is language. Enzymes are language. In order to go from the language of DNA to the language of enzymes, it has to be translated. But more than that, if these are actual languages, what does that mean? That they were designed by an intelligent entity. You cannot have language without there being intelligence. We understand that. If we see something that is a real language in our bodies, we then are forced to the conclusion that something made that. Something intelligent made that. So how do we translate from the language of DNA to the language of the enzyme? Before we get to that, if there are examples of true and distinct languages, and we've already kind of covered this, we'll just kind of summarize that the sequence of individual components within DNA has a meaning, just like the sequence of letters has meaning, the sequence of DNA therefore has meaning, and it's understood by the enzymes. The actual sequence of those components within that language is essential to retain the message. Just like if you switch EAT to ATE, you change the meaning. So if you take the code of DNA and you switch up the combination, you change the meaning. And if you change the meaning, then you're also then changing the downstream work that's going to be done. We have sentences that are part of that. We have individual letters. We have sentences that are within the genetic code. We have paragraphs that are within the genetic code. We have books that are within the genetic code. The message is the work which is done by the enzymes. So if the message is a language and small changes in the letters or the arrangements or moving one block to another changes the message, then you're messing with the work. Then you're changing the work or you're impeding the ability for that enzyme to do the work. So again, they have to have come from an intelligent source. All right, bear with me just a little bit. We're going to talk about how your body goes from translating to the genetic code language to the enzyme. So remember, DNA is this ladder, okay? In order to translate it, your body has to unspin that ladder, split it in half, and then copy it. But it copies it from the language of DNA to this middle language called RNA. So there's actually three different languages that are going in your cell. DNA, RNA, and then the enzymes. So it unspins it, it copies it, and then it moves that copy of RNA outside of the cell, where then that copy is then translated into the language of enzymes. Interestingly, if you look here, these are the terms that we as the geneticists have used. That copying is transcription. Well, what is that? That's a language term is what that is. When you transcribe from one thing to another, we know that because that's what we do in language. Well, that's what's been going on in the genes. then this translation, that's the term that geneticists use when going from RNA to the language of enzymes, is they call that translations. This here is all the stuff that goes on in that process. It's not a small process. The closer and closer you look, the more and more stuff that goes on. We have one enzyme that unspins the DNA. Then we have another enzyme that copies the DNA. Then we have another enzyme that re-spins the DNA and then rewraps it around. Then that RNA is then... Okay, so here's how it unspins it and copies it and re-spins it. Then that RNA is taken outside and then it's copied. And it's three letters at a time are made into each amino acid. So you have three letters, then you move to the next three letters, then you move to the next three letters. So as one ribbon is coming in to this thing called a ribosome, another ribbon is coming out. And that other ribbon of materials is all these strings of amino acids that are eventually going to make these enzymes. So these enzymes are this really long strings. Remember as kids where we had these little blocks that would lock into each other. Some would be round, some would be diamond shaped, some would be triangle, and they would be real flexible. That's kind of what an amino acid chain is. It's really flexible. However, it is only usable when it wraps itself up and folds into a three-dimensional structure. So it's not just the sequence of individual amino acids that's important. It has to fold itself into the right arrangement. If it doesn't fold itself into the right arrangement, it doesn't work. It doesn't do what it's programmed to do. So let's think back about when we change the message in the English language. Remember, at the fundamental level, evolutionary theory means that we have progressed from a small single cell organism to who we are today by random changes in that genetic code, which means you're replacing one letter at a time. You're deleting or adding letters. Or maybe you're pulling out a word and inserting a word. But all of this is random. Well, we've already shown how difficult it is to randomly generate words. Well, let's look at this phrase here, cheating is not allowed. And look what happens if we randomly switch things. Do we keep the same message? Well, we switch one letter for another letter. We switch the T to a W. Do we have a functional sentence? We have a functional sentence. Have we retained the original meaning? No, we have not retained the original meaning. Our sentence of cheating is not allowed. Now is cheating is now allowed. We have meaning, but it is not the same function. And because the message is different, the work is going to be different. So let's say we replace a word is with was. Do we, our original sentence, cheating is not allowed, it's now changed to cheating was not allowed. Is it a functional sentence? Yes. Has the meaning been retained? No, the meaning has not been retained. One is present tense, now the other is past tense. Heating is not allowed. We've taken out the letter C. We still have a letter, but instead of saying cheating, it's now heating. Heating is not allowed. And then we can start replacing letters with other letters, and now we no longer have a word. So you see, random changes don't retain meaning. If you randomly change individual letters or even words within a sentence, it's virtually impossible for that random change to maintain the original meaning. So, when we look at our DNA, how likely is it then that a random change is going to maintain that message, or if it changes the message, make that message better? Those random changes are called mutations, And geneticists fully admit the vast majority of mutations are harmful. The vast majority of mutations do not help out the body. If they are neutral, that's one thing, but most of the time, they are going to be harmful. So here's an example. Does everyone know what sickle cell anemia is? Okay. Sickle cell anemia is a disease where your red blood cells, instead of being these pliable jelly donut kind of things, turn into these elongated spears. And remember I told you that in the capillaries, that your capillaries, it's one red blood cell at a time that goes through those. Well, when they're really pliable, things go fine. But in sickle cell anemia, some of those elongate out and become spears where they're pointed. So now, when they go through those capillaries, they don't fold and they start poking. And sickle cell anemia can be very, very painful for those who suffer from it. It is a genetic disorder. It is something that you cannot get better from. It's part of your genes. So what we have here with sickle cell anemia is we have, this here is the original DNA, and sickle cell anemia is switching the T for an A. That's all you're doing, is changing one letter in the genetic code. And when you change that one letter in the language of DNA, in the language of enzymes, then you change out one amino acid, glutamine, for another amino acid called valine. Well, what does that mean? Remember when I told you that proteins fold up? When you switch out that one amino acid, you create a sticky spot within hemoglobin, and those hemoglobin molecules then start sticking to each other, and then they line up in rows. And when they line up in rows, this is what causes these real flexible donut-shaped red blood cells to elongate, and not only do they elongate, then that stickiness actually starts making it stiff. One change in one letter completely changes the protein and how it works and creates a genetic disorder. All right, we're mostly done with the really, really technical part. If you need some aspirin, go ahead and get some aspirin. But